a quorum yet, but as we've done in the past, and this, by the way, could be a rather interesting morning in the sense that we have some of our people literally across the hall with the Heritage Committee. They're finalizing their bill this morning, so several of our committee members are over there. But Representative Conan, what we've done now, and we don't quite have a quorum, Representative Conan has asked the author to present the bill. We'll take any questions from the members that are present, and then we'll temporarily lay it over if we don't have a quorum at that point, and take it up in a few minutes when we do. We're getting close to a quorum. We've had several people checking in and out. So, Representative Conan, if you could walk us through the bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And when you get a quorum, too, that we have, there's an amendment that needs to be released.
Yeah,
so.
Understand.
All right, thank you.
And if you want to, is the amendment crucial to your explanation of the bill? Okay, why don't you...
My explanation will include the amendment.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to proceed then.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman and members, this is the claims bill, House File 1193. And this year there were over 100 claims that came into the committee, and what you see before you are the claims that the committee decided to make good. To the Department of Corrections, there's a total of $52,552.23, and this is from the general fund to the Department of Corrections. What this is for personal injuries and also coverage for permanent injuries and medical services provided to persons who work in sentence to serve programs, community work service, institutional community work, that would be crew work, and also for prisoners who suffered permanent injuries doing assigned work at correctional facilities. And again, that total was $52,552.23. There's also a claim that which involves deed, and these funds come from the department existing funds, and that total is $13,517. And this was for Nancy Tecklenburg. And it was an unemployment compensation issue, and there was a mistake made at deed, and so what this does is rectify the mistake. Ms. Tecklenburg had applied for unemployment, but she had almost just short of a year's worth of severance pay coming. At the point that her severance pay ended, she was supposed to contact the department, and they were supposed to reset the clock, and so she'd get a year's worth of unemployment compensation. However, at the department, they made the mistake. That didn't happen, and she, if I remember right, she actually only got one unemployment check, and so this makes up the difference. The final part of the bill is Department of Revenue. And this one is a settlement of $1,412 from the general fund to the Department of Revenue, and for Mary Aggie from Forest Lake. And she had a situation where she mailed in her property tax refund, and the department didn't receive the refund. She had a friend with her who witnessed her mailing the refund, and so the committee felt that the department should make that application good. Also, we asked the department to do to take a look at her returns to make sure the amount was correct, and they did that, and that's the amount we ended up with, was $1,412. The total claims bill comes to $53,964.23, and committee, Mr. Chair and committee members, that's the bill.
We have a quorum present, by the way, so why don't we get the bill officially before us. The chair moves that House File 1193 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. and...
Mr. Chair, we need the amendment in...
Yeah, and I just, yeah, that's the motion to put it before us. The next step, the chair moves the amendment, and that's the 0449 amendment. So that puts the bill in the order that the author would like. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Mr. Lindecky, earlier you made an announcement before this committee and something about it being your last claims bill. Well, welcome back. I guess nothing is ever permanent then.
Mr. Chair, I was afraid you'd mention that. I am fully intended to have retired before this year's session started. And then, and particularly after 2 years in a row, having Dennis Osment stand and congratulate me for all the work I've done and have the entire House of Representatives applaud me, it was a wonderful thing. But then... and so I don't expect that to happen again, of course. But then, of course, September happened, and all of a sudden seemed like the economy and all of the money that that had been set aside for retirement wasn't quite there anymore the way I had planned it to be. And so I decided to stay.
And I've heard that an awful lot of people have chosen to delay retirement. Well, to say welcome back. But I keep seeing you in the hallway and what have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Around. Appreciate that.
And we'll still applaud you when that final day ultimately right. comes. Any discussion on the bill? Representative Kissmark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't see you back there.
Yes, I know. It's a little hard to do that today. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have three questions, and again, it's somewhat of a new area, the claims bill thing. My first question is, the criteria, are any claims rejected, and how do you decide for those who are accepted?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kiffmeyer, there are claims rejected, yes. Some are, you know, the committee, of course, hears every claim, and in some cases, some of the individuals involved actually show up or we interview on the telephone, so we look at each one individually, and some are discredited and not paid. Some, if you look at like the personal injury and permanent injury kind of claims, we kind of follow the guideline of workman's compensation and use those guidelines to set the amount. If there's direct medical expense, of course, that is covered. And so it's kind of an example of what we do. If you look at, and by the way, most of these are Department of Corrections injury claims. The two exceptions this year, of course, are deed and revenue. And I don't know if you were here when I went through that or not, but yeah, there's some examples there where we actually look at it and try and pull the details out and decide if, in fact, there's a legitimate claim there, and that's what we did in these cases.
Okay. Second question is, why did these come out of the general fund? Why wouldn't these be dealt with through the Department of Corrections from their budget or from these budgets? I know that usually... agencies when or departments or anything like that, offices, when employees come with them, any of the HR, any of those workers' comp, unemployment, all those things come out of that entity's budget. So why are these things not coming out of the agency budget and why are they coming out of the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, for deeds, that one did come out of the existing department fund. The other two come out of the general fund. And, you know, I'm rather new at this committee, so I'm going to let Mr. Lindecky go through that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, for the prisoner claims, and again, you asked how many claims we reject. We have most of the 100 or so claims that we deal with are prisoner property claims. And, you know, they have some very expensive Nikes and stuff that get lost. Whatever, they have all kinds of property claims that they present to us. And we have rejected for years virtually all of those. The only ones we get are the ones that the department has already chosen not to pay. They pay some on their own, the ones they feel they're responsible for the loss. So that's what most of the rejected claims are. We had a couple of very serious claims this year, one of them against the IRRRB that we listened to and paid a lot of attention to, and then unfortunately had to reject, even though the person was permanently injured, paralyzed in a wheelchair. It wasn't the state's fault. And so there are a lot of reasons for rejecting claims. Now, as to why the money comes from the general fund, for the prisoner injury claims, the statute, I think it's 3.732 or one of the sections like that, says that if a person is injured in prison or in Department of Human Services facility, the only place that person can go to get recovery for those injuries is the legislature. And so those are directed straight to the claim subcommittee. The Department of Corrections doesn't have the opportunity to pay any of those permanent injury claims. So they come to the legislature, and the Department of Corrections then, of course, has plenty to spend its money on. And the legislature finds the money to pay those claims for injuries out of the general fund, which is appropriate, I believe.
That pretty much answers my questions. I just appreciate the information and the knowledge about that, and that'll be it for now. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, we always check with Mr. Marks to see if he's got the money and which year to take it out of. So it's a very carefully constructed bill in that regard.
And we all know Mr. Marks has a
checkbook. That's right.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor that House File 1193 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the committee in ways and means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Is Representative Lilly here? Is Doty here? Oh, okay, Representative Doty. And Representative Sun.
I move the State Government Finance Division report for House Bill 18, the first engrossment. And then I move.
We're on the Doty bill. Lilly wasn't present.
Okay.
They're going to find him. So we're down one bill. No, that's fine.
Okay.
You want to move?
State Government Finance Division report for House Bill 905, the first engrossment.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, and all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Representative
Sun. So I move House File 905, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us, and if Representative Doty, if you could explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, under current law, the Adjutant General is allowed to accept money but not volunteer services, either from public or private sources. And they have found, with especially the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon campaign, that there is a couple of very active volunteers, and they would like to be able to enter into contracts with them and pay them mileage. And that is basically this bill.
Okay. Any discussion on the bill?
Chairman?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Doty, if you're going to enter into contracts with them and you're going to pay a mileage, then they're no longer volunteers. So I don't understand what we're doing.
Representative
The contract that they'll be entering into will talk about volunteer service. The only payment, as I understand it, would be the mileage.
Any further discussion?
Over
here.
Oh, Representative Khan.
That's not really related to this bill. Do we have any more dumb laws like this around that we could, any absence of things that we could just kind of generally do? So that anyone is allowed to have volunteer service of some kind?
No. Rep. Tempon, I'm not sure whether you're...
Well, I'm just, I don't want to use this bill as a vehicle, but maybe it would be something a little, something
okay,
what, reasonable
what,
to look
direction
at.
You were heading there?
Well, that was just because this bill is before us to say that you have to pass a law to allow somebody to accept volunteer service. I mean, give me a break.
Well, I think the gist of the bill, though, is to allow payment for
yeah.
the mileage. That's what drives it. Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd love to work with Representative Connor next. Yes. I think we do have a lot of dumb law on the books. And I think of one of them, you know, the fact that city council members and mayors can't pay themselves less if they choose to, and things along those lines. And so I'd love to clear some of those things off the books to give people the authority to do what they want to do. They want to pay themselves $10. I'd like them to be able to pay themselves $10. And so there's lots of those. I look forward to working with you.
Back today.
Let's keep going.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, I think I totally agree with the bill and what it wants to do and all of those things. I think it's excellent. I think the only thing here is that it would be good to have this be for any government, any level of government, local, state, or whatever. And is it in order to do, I mean, would that be... Mm-hmm. appropriate to do just a oral amendment, or is that done?
Well, how complicated would the oral amendment be? That would be the question. And Representative Kahn, this came out of your division.
So I should have. Just like I should have amended the Lilly bill in my division to put domestic.
Oh, maybe we're not
it.
Done the Lilly bill. We're on
we don't do everything.
We can't do that. Is what I'm informed.
Mr. Chairman, it may be a little more complicated
yeah.
than it appears. This is coded in the part of the yeah. statute that deals with the Adjutant General, and we. In that particular section of the statute, we couldn't make it apply across all units of government.
Okay. So, Representative Kiffmeyer, that answers your question,
I'll
I guess.
Hold the idea, but not move any amendment at this
Might
time.
We're near the end of the session, maybe a bill for next session or something, too. That would be an alternative.
Maybe Representative Kahn and Representative Broad and I could work on that.
Sounds like you're all on the same page, right? Representative Bisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sodi, can the Adjutant General enter into a contract for services? Do they have the ability and powers to do that right now?
You can identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Colonel Eric Allman, Department of Military Affairs, Government Relations. We currently do not have the ability to enter in a contract for receiving volunteer services because it's prohibited by state statute to do that. We lifted this statute language from the Department of Veterans Affairs, which has the authority, and as discussed earlier, if we wanted to go broader, you'd have to look at the Section 15 state statute, I think. So that's the statute that covers all the government agencies. But this would just allow us to accept those volunteer services on an individual basis or as a group to help us out in our reintegration efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, that wasn't my question. My question was, can you enter into contracts right now for paid services?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Yes, we can enter in for paid services.
So then, Mr. Chair, to testify, why wouldn't you enter into a contract where the payment is their mileage, and then you're done? There's no need for any other statutory language.
Mr. Chair, Representative, when we're dealing with groups and we're entering into a contract with that, just to clarify, we'd enter into a contract for free services with a group or a nonprofit organization. When we're dealing with individuals, we would not enter into a contract with them. What we'd do is put them on an invitational travel order, and at that point, we'd just reimburse them up to, with it, or should I say, we'd reimburse them in accordance with state procedures, so we don't have a taxable event for them. If we paid them, then it would create a taxable event, and we don't want to do that for volunteers or stepping out to help our service members.
We're having some interference, members, the cell phones, so if you could check yours and turn them off. I just turned mine off. I did that as well. Representative Bisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, then, Representative Kahn. renews her motion that House File 905, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and place on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We have the minutes. Representative Biskins, have you looked at those?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I would move the minutes from Thursday, April 30th.
Okay, motion is before us. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Is Representative Lilly here? No, he's right there. Good morning. We got a quick change. We got a couple of motions that we need. Representative Kahn now on 1218.
Yes. Okay, I move the division report on 1218.
The first engrossment. Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Kahn?
Then I move past file 1218, the first engrossment be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, motion is before us. Representative Lilly, if you could explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn, no amendments this morning, please?
I just didn't get around to it. So.
Oh, I'm glad you slept well. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1218 ratifies the actions of the Legislative Coordinating Commission Subcommittee on Employee Relations. We're made up of five members of the Minnesota House and the Senate, bipartisan members, and most of the contracts and plans were negotiated a year and a half ago and ratified by the 2008 legislature. With the exception of, you'll see in subdivision 10, these are the remaining contracts. So, with me today I have, Mr. Hubinger, and he can go through the bill if you'd like. I'm not sure how much you want to hear about it, or, I've seen already in some of our other stops along the way. So, maybe I'll pass it to Mr. Hubinger and he can go through the bill if that's okay this morning, so. Okay.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. If you'd like, I'd run through each of the subdivisions very briefly to tell you what's in there. Subdivision 1 ratifies a contract with the State University Administrative Service faculty. The terms of that contract are similar to those of the other contracts. Subdivisions 2 and 3 ratify amendments to the Commissioner's Plan and the Managerial Plan. The only substantive change in there was in the Commissioner's Plan to deal with salary differentials for medical doctors in Greater Minnesota. Subdivisions 4, 5, and 6 ratify salary increases for the directors of the three statewide pension funds. Those directors, after a compensation study was completed, received salary increases of 12%. Subdivision 7 ratifies the compensation plan for the State Board of Investment. That board was having difficulty with high staff turnover and also contracted for a compensation study. As a result, that consultant recommended increases in the salary ranges and in salaries for those staff, and this plan implements those increases. Subdivision 8 ratifies an arbitration award for the Minnesota Nurses Association. That's an essential employee unit under PELRA. The arbitrator awarded the state pattern but provided some language that the Nurses Association was seeking on the assignment of overtime. Subdivision 9 ratifies the compensation plan for the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Their staff used to be covered under two other compensation plans. There was legislation in 2008 that authorized a new plan for the Legislative Auditor. This new plan is one that resembles one that is provided for other joint legislative staff. And as Representative Lilly indicated, Subdivision 10 is the only contract that applies to the next biennium. This would ratify a new contract for the State University faculty. It essentially freezes salaries for those faculty. Other terms and conditions of the 2008-2009 contract would continue.
Okay, are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, you're the witness. I guess the witness first. Who got 12%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmers, the three directors of the statewide pension boards, TRA, MSRS, and TERA.
This is for either or. How does the current freeze apply, or why doesn't it apply to these?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the freeze is prospective and applies to the next biennium. For those contracts that are being negotiated now, subdivisions 1 through 9 deal with contracts and plans for the current biennium, yes, where we have 2 months left to them.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, so we're looking backwards. This work's already been done under these agreements, and now we're going to ratify them?
Ms. Kibinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, that's correct.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kibinger, Representative Lilly, can you help me, can you put a little context or color around the statement in the memo here from the Subcommittee on Employee Relations? It says Minnesota Management and Budget. This is on the first page, about two-thirds of the way down. Minnesota Management and Budget estimates that the increased cost of all collective bargaining agreements and plans will be 5.93% in this biennium. I assume that's the 08-09? Is that right? In the 08-09 biennium, with an impact of 9.62% on the next biennium. Can you help me? I mean, everybody recognizes the fact that we're in serious financial, we've got serious financial challenges, and I understand we're ratifying some agreements, primarily ratifying agreements that have already been reached, but was there any discussion or any effort to take a look at whether what we agreed to last summer makes sense given what we know today?
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, certainly the world has changed quite a bit since last fall, and you know, certainly these are questions. These are negotiated between the governor's staff and the employee work group. Actually, as a union member, I might negotiate them different than he might. But these are all absorbed. Just keep in mind, they're all absorbed into the budget. So, you know, they're not growing the budgets at all. I mean, they're going to find a way to pay for them. But, yes, the world's changed. So you're 100% right. And you'll see that in Article 10 or Subdivision 10 because the contracts are quite different. So it's hard to go back on an agreed-upon contract. But certainly the world has changed.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly, I appreciate that, and I recognize that what we're doing here is ratifying agreements that were reached last summer. The concern I have is that the effect of ratifying agreements that provide for, generically across the board, essentially a 6% increase in this biennium with even larger impacts in the next biennium, is that that puts additional pressures on the state budget, which I know you appreciate, and could result in the need for us to terminate a larger number of employees than we would otherwise have to if we had either held down the increases, and again, the world has changed since these were negotiated, or if we had, collectively the administration and the unions were to come back and say maybe we should take another look at them with the goal of saving as many jobs as we can. And I know that nobody's wanting to see state employees lose their jobs, and I know there's no guarantee that they will, but that's the concern I have, Representative Lilly. I think that we're putting additional pressures. Yes, it's built into the forecast. Yes, it's in the base, but we've got a $6.4 billion problem, and the result of that, unfortunately, is going to be not only people across the state not seeing the same level of services as they have in the past, but it's going to mean fewer state employees most likely. And it's things like this that add pressure and increase the potential for more state employees to lose their job. I don't want to see that. I know you don't want to see that. And I wish that that the administration and the collective bargaining units had gotten together and at least taken a look at whether what they had agreed to back last July makes sense in today's world, but I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair. And I just hope that I hope we don't end up having to lay off additional state employees because of the decisions that we made in the past.
Yeah, two most were comments, not looking for a response. Representative Hitmeyer.
Well, I believe my question was answered, Mr. Chairman, by being able to look at this additional information today, so it answers the question. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then the chair renews the motion by Representative Conlon, House File 1218, the first engrossment. They recommended the pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Murphy is in the audience somewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Oh, there, right behind the table. Okay. I have a tendency to look to the side, not straight ahead, so I... Representative Huntley, would you care to move the division report?
Mm-hmm.
For 1988, that was before your division. Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair, I would move the Health Care and Human Services Plan Division Report for House File 1988, First Committee in Grossman.
Okay, motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, and all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Huntley.
So I move House File 1988, First Committee in Grossman, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Murphy, if you could explain the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1988 seeks to provide information to the legislature regarding provider payments paid through managed care organizations and county-based purchasers. I want to thank the Department of Human Services, the representatives of the county-based purchasers, and the managed care organizations in Minnesota. We've had quite a discussion about this, and while there's still some disagreement about the language, I think we're in a place where we have legislation before us that I believe that we can pass and provide some utility to the legislature as we move forward on health care and health care reform. This comes out of work that we started back in 2007 when we had the working groups looking at how we pay for health care and recognizing there are transactions that occur once legislation is passed. The Department of Human Services negotiates with managed care organizations negotiate with providers, and those transactions are literally blind to us. Those transactions will remain blind to us, but we're going to ask that the Commissioner collect some information from the managed care organizations and county-based purchasers, do some analysis of that, and report that back to the legislature in order to make some better decisions. There is no fiscal note to this legislation, and I would ask for your support.
Okay, any discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair. Representative for you or for Representative Murphy, was there a fiscal impact at some point? We took it out somewhere? It's the same question I asked a week or so ago. Why are we here in finance? Was it because there was a fiscal impact at one point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, we've worked very carefully with the Department of Human Services and with the stakeholders to try and produce legislation that will yield information for us without costing the Department of Human Services extra money. So there's not been a fiscal impact attached to this, and we're here because we went through the Health and Human Services Finance Division.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then... Representative Huntley renews his motion that House File 1988, the First Committee in Grossman, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. We now have Representative Kelly, House File 1565, Representative Huntley.
I move the Health Care and Human Services Plan Division Report for House File 1565, First Committee in Grossman.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Huntley.
I move House File 1565, First Committee in Grossman, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us, and Representative Huntley, there's an amendment. Do you need Representative Kelly, the amendment on the bill, to explain it? Do you want to take it now?
Yes, sir.
So that'll put the bill in the order you'd like, Representative Huntley?
I would move the A2 amendment.
Okay, the motion is for the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Kelly, if you could explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Huntley for moving that amendment. I can tell you the amendment first is simply reinstating language that inadvertently took away an inflation adjustment for another project within the same section. So that's what the amendment does. And to the bill, fostering healthy seniors is a collaborative effort between several organizations, both private and public, including Fairview Hospitals, Benedictine Health Systems, and Goodhue County. The project allows us to build a new long-term care facility in Goodhue County while closing two others, which results actually in a reduction of beds and a zero fiscal note, which, of course, we are very excited about.
But looking forward, we actually look forward to an actual savings to the state overall. Before we stand for questions, we'd just like to say that we are certainly reaping the rewards of many people who've gone before us on these projects. Representative Patty Fritz, who had the project out of Steele County, Representative Huntley and Representative Thiessen worked on that. So we appreciate the work that went on before us. And also it goes along with what Representative Thiessen's Communities for a Lifetime initiative has been. So we are excited about this project. I have with me Scott Wertelman from Fairview Health Systems and Mike Schultz from Benedictine Health Systems. We'll stand for questions.
Okay, and in the full finance, we just have expert witnesses available for questions. So,
okay.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kelly, or for one of your witnesses, I see there's no, the fiscal note's essentially a zero. You mentioned that the project, when it's completed, is actually going to result in a reduction in the number of beds. And I guess the only question I have is, you know, given the demographic shift, and I know we're transitioning toward as much sort of home-based care or alternative care as opposed to the more traditional nursing home type setting, does that assumption, I mean, does that make sense? Are you going to be back here, Representative Kelly, in 6 or 7 years saying, oops, we need some more beds down my way?
Certainly appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cole. Appreciate the question. I'll let those who looked at the demographics of that to answer that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Wertelman. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of Fairview Red Wing Health Services in Red Wing. And the facility that's related to this bill that we operate is Fairview Seminary Home. It is an 85-bed skilled nursing care facility. Our census today is about 60 residents, so we have excess capacity currently in our facility, as do our colleagues at Benedictine Health System. And what we're really attempting to do is rationalize what is now a significant overcapacity of long-term care beds in Goodhue County, estimated to be about 129, and try to reformat the delivery of care to really push the care for our seniors out into the community. We've got a head start on that through a program that we've been able to collaboratively develop working with Goodhue County in actually doing what we call Partners in Aging. We've actually been able to demonstrate that we can keep people out of the long-term care setting in their home and a higher quality of life. So we recognize that this is a fairly bold move. We're in essence taking 69 long-term care beds out of our community. But we believe that we have about 3 years to really work effectively to put the transition in place, and we believe there's enough capacity in the system. So based upon what we see today, we do not believe that we will be coming back for additional beds.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Representative Kelly, and to your witnesses, I appreciate the effort to try something new, and I appreciate the what I'll characterize as a serious or sincere look at you know what exists today and what makes sense for tomorrow. I guess I hope you're not back in a couple of years asking for more beds. I hope that your projections are correct, but I applaud you for taking a new look and trying to do long-term care for our seniors in the way that makes the most sense in today's day and age. So, Representative Kelly, thanks for bringing the bill forward, and thanks to your witnesses for coming here to testify.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, this is really a good idea, and it's our current law, if you close one nursing home, you can't move those beds any more than 5 miles, I believe. And I think we did one for you last year or the year before that allows that. And many of these nursing homes, we'd be better off if we tore them down and built new ones, to be honest. And this allows a more integrated system in one central location, which I think is better for the seniors than the way we need to go. So you want me to move?
Well, we've moved the bill. We just need to renew the motion unless there's further discussion. Representative Kiffmeyer, I guess, has a question first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Huntley and Representative Kelly as well. You know, I think this is a good thing to do. Having been a district board member of a hospital and with that a nursing home, especially these days, nursing homes have clients who are much more ill, need a lot of support. Nursing homes of yesterday are no longer the same again. So, you know, making it easy to go back and forth between a hospital and a nursing home in particular
But having the package of gradual support, what you find is seniors living in their own homes, and they get to a certain point where they need some help, but not a lot. And then a little more, and a little more, and a little more. The more we can make that an easy transition for them, more fun actually, with a lot of the support services, they generally have less depression, they're healthier, their medications are more balanced. So, you know, I think this is a good approach, and I do agree that many of the nursing homes are so, their buildings are just not up to standards and are costly. So, you know, sometimes just starting fresh and reintegrating it really works well. So congratulations on taking this step, although I do think in any step there are risks for the future. So I'm sure you'll walk carefully.
Representative Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I 100% agree with Representative Huntley on this one. So it's nice to be in the same place on this. But, you know, one of my hopes is actually as we allow these more flexibility is that we do it in a way using some pilot projects like this, Representative Huntley, that at some point we take our hands off and give the homes some flexibility and allow them to do what they do best, which is run their facilities and provide those services. And so I hope that this is a huge success. I congratulate you for moving in this direction, and I hope that we can use you guys as an example for how we might increase flexibility overall within the system, because it's absolutely the direction we have to go. So, Representative Kelly, I congratulate you for bringing this forward and look forward to seeing this move along in the process and use it as a model.
Representative Huntley renews his motion, and that House File 1565, the First Committee Engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and place on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We'll now go to House File 108 by Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
You're welcome. Thank you. Representative Kamarn. Okay, I guess he just stepped down. The chair moves the Public Safety Finance Division report for House File 108, the First Committee Engrossment. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
That's 1-0, I guess. All those. Well, I haven't called for the opposed yet. All those opposed. Motion carries. The chair moves that House File 108, the First Engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. And I understand, Representative Norton, you have an amendment. The chair moves the amendment H.O. 108A8. And Representative Norton, you might want to just briefly explain the amendment.
I certainly will, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. It had originally been intended on in the primary seatbelt legislation this year that we would continue our $25 fine, and we had hoped to drop the surcharge. We got a fiscal note back from Judiciary, and it was too onerous. And so what we're doing is just simply returning to current law, and that's what this amendment does.
Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, and all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Norton, if you'd care to explain the bill.
Yes, I will, Mr. Chair, and I don't know how much time you want to have, and but I do want to just brief you on a few of the details. Thank you very much for hearing the bill. This is a bill that can save lives, lower health care costs, and empower our law enforcement agencies to uphold the laws that are already on the books here in the state of Minnesota. Year after year, traffic crashes are the leading cause of injury among Minnesotans and leading cause of death for folks ages 1 to 34. It's also the leading cause of work-related death and a significant cause of worker disability. Over 1,900 Minnesotans are killed or injured on our roads each year, and many of them are preventable. In fact, a majority of those people killed were not buckled up. Passing primary seatbelt legislation, which entails no cost to the state or the public, is the quickest, cheapest, most cost-effective way to increase seatbelt use and compliance. That has been proven in states that have moved from secondary to primary seatbelt laws. 27 states now have primary seatbelt laws. First and foremost, primary seatbelt is about saving lives and preventing injury. However, I do think it's worth pointing out that there are not only costs of lives, but there's also the hospital costs involved. It's believed that we can save $7 million immediately, annually, ongoing, just by passing the seatbelt law and the hospital-related costs associated with that. A Minnesota study looked at crash and hospital charge data for the 2004-2005 year and found that unbelted motorists have 60% higher costs than belted victims. And government sources, including Medicaid, are charged $42 million a year for unbelted hospital charges in the years covered by that study. So let me just say that primary seatbelt is currently, with our current seatbelt law, we are having about 87% compliance for those driving during daytime hours. It is hoped that by passing primary seatbelt, and if other state law changes are reflective, we hope to get that to about 95% compliance. Two-thirds of Minnesota residents agree that law enforcement officers should be able to stop vehicle if occupants aren't wearing their seatbelts, and that's according to a Corona Research survey that was done in recent years. A wide range of organizations support this, and you've been provided in your background information with the orange cover that data as well. Another important point that I just want to mention is one aimed at protecting our kids. When drivers buckle up, children in the vehicles are buckled up 90% of the time. When drivers don't wear their seatbelts, the children in the vehicle are restrained only 25% of the time, and that's according to a study done by the American Academy of Pediatrics. So primary seatbelt really has no downside. It costs the state nothing, brings in federal dollars, and that's something I wanted to touch on in this committee. We will, if we can pass this legislation by July 30th, 2009, we will get $3.4 million of federal funds, and in a year when we're facing a deficit, I think that's worth considering as well. Lastly, it's estimated that at least 30 deaths will be prevented annually with the passage of this bill. And as mentioned before, there's economic savings due to health-related costs that I know the Health Care Committee is interested in as well. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. I will say that we've just gotten some data. A press release went out from the department that said to date we have in Minnesota 104 fatalities. There were 8 deaths in April. 5 of those were not wearing their seatbelt. There were also another 4 unbelted motorists were seriously injured, and they were all ejected from their cars. This is the type of thing we want to prevent with this legislation, and I think this is the time to do it. Mr. Chair, I stand for any questions.
Any discussion on the bill? Seeing none, then all those in favor,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, what's the motion before the body?
The motion is that House File 108, the first committee in vote engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the General Register.
Mr. Chairman, I have a concern with that motion. Mr. Chairman, all bills that have had a fiscal note or fiscal impact on the state have been referred to the Committee on Ways and Means to this point. I don't understand why we would move this one to the General Register and not to the Committee on Ways and Means.
The amendment that we put on made the there's no longer a fiscal impact. She referred it back to current law with that author's amendment that the chair moved on her behalf.
So, Mr. Chair, then the fiscal note we have in front of us is void?
Yeah, that is now void with the amendment. Although we have
Mr. Chair,
the fifth of all, let me check something here. We've got the chair will have to make a. When I originally made the motion, I thought that there will be some federal dollars coming in, so it will have to go to Ways and Means. I was in error in that original motion, so the motion is or will be to send it to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina.
You know, Mr. Chair and members, I recall years ago when we first passed the seatbelt law and we promised everybody in the state that would, you know, wouldn't be a primary offense, and then we've tried to change it several times over those years. But I don't know where you guys folks come from, but where I come from, usually a police officer can stop you for whatever reason he wants and then give you a ticket for not having your seatbelt on, so I don't really see the need for this. And, you know, I'm just tired of nicking the common working person. It seems all the time here, so I know, Representative Kahn, you aren't going to agree with me, but I'm the good liberal on this committee. I believe in liberty, so, you know.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, I became a supporter of seatbelts before there were even seatbelt fixtures in cars. Because in my first year in a physics class in graduate school, the TA teaching the physics class had us do a simple mathematical exercise, which I know is the kind of thing that people don't like to consider in the legislature. But what you did is you just increased the number of G's on a person who was involved in a head-on crash. I think the speed was something not even very high, like 40 miles an hour, thing I just got a speeding ticket for the other day without any kind of profiling. But what happened when the body hit the dashboard at that 40 miles an hour, and what happened when the belted person had the decrease in gravity with the gradually transmitting the energy through the front end of the car. And I'm sorry, I don't remember what the number was anymore. I just remember what the exercise was. We immediately went and got the things put into our cars and got the seat belts, which were just belts at that time, put on, and we've been rigorous about doing it ever since. So education does have some benefits. So, you know, the laws of physics say that we should pass Kim Norton's bill, not the laws of the state. So. Okay.
Okay. I just Volkamp just informed me. I guess there's some of us here that are on planning and fiscal policy, and that meeting has been delayed, so by way of announcement. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then the chair renews the motion that House File 108, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll now revert back. There was a bill that we had earlier on the agenda that I think the author is here now. Yes, Representative. And is Representative Clark here? Okay. The chair moves that the Housing Policy and Finance and Public Health Finance Division report to House File 985, First Committee Engrossment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The chair moves that Senate File 666 be recommended to pass and place on the general register. This is one where we now have the Senate file in our possession. So, and the agents are passing it out right now. Ms. Thornhill just informed me. So, if you would explain the bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your indulgence. House File 985, our Senate now six file 666. This bill will allow youth who age out of care or who run from care after age 15 to come back to a youth-serving social service system for help if they need it. This option is only currently available to wards of the state. Each year in Minnesota, approximately 600 youth prepare to leave home for good. Because these youth have been removed from their families and have not been given permanent families, turning 18 can mean that they are truly on their own. Foster youth are no more ready for independence at age 18 than their non-foster care peers. 95% of Americans who are 25 or older before they are able to leave are 25 or older before they are able to live self-sufficiently on their own. Less than 10% of 18-year-olds live on their own. Recent estimates suggest that a parent provides their young adult children with material assistance totaling approximately $38,000 after they reach the age of 18. Parent time assisting their 18 to 34-year-old children averages 367 hours per year. This is 9 weeks of full-time help. 61% of college students receive financial support from their parents. These are our young people for whom we've accepted the responsibility of removing them from their parents and placing them in care. We need to provide what all good parents provide, a place to return for help when things go wrong or the expected supports go away. So essentially what we propose and hope is that counties would develop a plan with young people who have been put in permanency or in foster care between the years of 18 and 21. As the bill has kind of traveled its path, some of the significant issues that have been worked out is the fiscal responsibility of counties, which you might imagine they wanted to be sure that this wasn't a mandate, and so we have worked out some language through the process in the Senate file that they can kind of opt in or opt out in this program. One county in particular, our second biggest, I imagine, or one of our large counties, Ramsey County, already does this to great success. One of the things that this does is it helps young people who have aged out of foster care and don't have a family or support. It allows them to stay connected, to go on to college, to get a job, to have a place to call home. In fact, a place that they can go back and have Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner. It also, for us, allows us to hopefully get these young people on their way and they don't kind of turn to the safety net or institutional systems that we have in case they don't do well. That is essentially the bill, and I'll stand for your questions, members.
Yeah, are there questions? Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hayden, I don't necessarily have a concern about what you're trying to do here, but I guess my question is, you know, there's been a lot of talk this year. Representative Lanning and others bipartisanly have been talking about trying to relieve mandates on counties and local units of government. And if I'm reading the language right on page 3, we are now placing a new mandate of creating a detailed plan onto our county social services agencies. And you know, I talked to the people in Carver County, and they're already overburdened as it is. And you know, I'm not opposed to what you're trying to do here, but we're creating another mandate and another piece of work for people who are already overworked. And help me understand why we should be doing that, given the situation we're in, beyond what you've already explained.
Sure.
Speak to the mandate, please.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Cole. In talking to people in the county that I spoke to and those that brought me the bill, one of the problems is that these kids still need this help. So they're going to do the work anyways, or at least someone in our system. And one of the things that I have been able to understand throughout my career, and especially coming here, is that we think of these things in a silo-driven way. So one particular social worker in the Children and Family Services says, I'm overburdened, I don't want to do this work. But then somebody in corrections is going to have to pick that up. Or someone, if they have a child in the family social division, is going to have to pick that up. So though one particular part of our system may feel like this is a mandate and overburden, and by the way, they can opt in or opt out. But in another part of our system, if we don't provide young people the support that they need, that we all kind of provide our young folks when they turn 18, if we don't help those young folks that have been mandated in the system make a transition to adulthood, then we pick that up in another part of the system. So I can appreciate, first of all, there's an opt-in, opt-out clause, but I can appreciate people saying that they're overworked, but I also know that this young person, typically without the supports that they need, are going to end up in another part of our system, costing us probably a lot more in terms of what we would have to do in our safety net or institutions versus helping them kind of move along and provide them with some supports that they can be successful.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Hayden, Ms. Novak showed me that on the second page of the fiscal note, there's a reference to an administrative rule, and this is expanding what is currently done by administrative rule somewhat, but is similar to it. I guess the last question I have, Representative Hayden, I think your bill would probably have a greater fiscal impact on our counties if you didn't have the language. You say that foster care benefits available until age 21, the section 2 of your bill. There's some language in here that says counties got to make those services available to the extent funds are available. And I guess my question, Representative Hayden, I appreciate the flexibility there, but is that an exception that's going to kind of swallow the rule? Are there funds available to provide services today to kids who are 18, 19, 20 years old and in need of some help? Or are we doing something that's going to, at the end of the day, have little or no effect?
Mr. Chair, I think that there are young people who graduated or who leave the foster care system at 18 that are destitute and, you know, are able for our public, safety net benefits and that they can go and, you know, apply for them. I think that what we hope that the county's doing. And, you know, matter of fact, in particular, when we have this bill heard in other committees, what Ramsey County does is that is an asset for them, that they are able to work with that young person and help them manage whatever benefits that they have available to them, but with the hope that they kind of, if they need it, they get it, and then they get off. They get on with their lives. So I guess the answer to your question the wrong way is that a lot of those benefits are available, and what we hope is kind of a de facto case management, and that's essentially what our families are when we're 18 to 21 years old. They kind of case manage us, if we think about it in the social work term, help us through all of the things that we, you know, we're kind of going out into this world and we don't know what to expect, and ultimately our parents kind of pull us back and kind of give us lessons, help us through, spend a little money with us, help us think through some of the choices that we make if they weren't good choices. And essentially that's what we're asking the counties and the state to help our young people do. By no means are we kind of forcing them in, or that we want them to stay, or that we're going to spend more money than we need to, but we also are hoping that de facto case management, if you will, help prevent them from making choices that are going to make them reliant upon us for the long term.
Okay, any further discussion? Well, seeing none, then Chair renews his motion that Senate File 666 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Members, we meet again in this room tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, room 5. And one of the bills that we'll hopefully have up tomorrow will be the Heritage bill that is being completed as we speak across the hall. So with that, meeting adjourned.